From the land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 11th day of March, 2025. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Naomi Bloom. She's at TotalFarmMarketing.com. We'll hear from Neil Dahlstrom. He's the author of Tractor Wars. That documentary, based on the book, that is, will air tonight on our companion station, WILL TV Channel 12 at 7 p.m. And we'll hear, too, from John Reed. He's the director at the Center for Digital Agriculture here on campus and spoke at last week's All Day Ag Outlook about autonomous agriculture and his expectations for the farm in the Midwest. And we'll do all of that on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Online, on demand at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn at $4.70 and a quarter, a penny and three quarters lower. December at $4.54 and a half, down a half cent. May beans today at $10.11 and a quarter, down two and three quarters. And new crop November at $10.15 and a half, down two and a quarter. Wheat futures July soft red, down 5.5 cents. Naomi Bloom from TotalFarmMarketing.com now joins us to take a look at the marketplace on this USDA report. Report day. Naomi, first I want to go through a couple of paragraphs that USDA included in the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates report this morning about tariffs. It says that the WASDE report only considers trade policies that are in effect at the time of publication. That's long running. We know that's the case. So here's how they're dealing with what's in place and not in place at the moment. They say U.S. tariffs on Canada and Mexico have been suspended until April the 2nd for all products covered under USMCA, which included most of the ag products. Reciprocal tariffs are also scheduled to begin on April 2nd. However, until those go into effect, WASDE does not incorporate them into its forecast. Despite U.S. tariffs being suspended, Canada's retaliatory tariffs remain in place. These are accounted for, says the agency in today's WASDE, and U.S. tariffs on China and China's retaliatory tariffs on the U.S. are assumed to remain in place. So those numbers are all calculated into what USDA put out this morning. There weren't that many changes. Can you talk to me a little bit about what took place?
Right. So looking at corn on today's USDA report, there were absolutely no changes from the March report back to the February report, back to the January report. So as we all remember, the January report is what was so game changer friendly. But now since that report, the USDA has made no production or ending stocks changes or demand changes on the February or today's report. So we're still sitting with an old crop situation that is really friendly for corn and really supportive, but we're always kind of on this anxious cusp of what will potential trade or tariff wars do for the future, along with the corn market knowing that we're going to see an increase of acres most likely down the road. Now, on the soybean report today, they made just a minor tweak. They lowered the demand for seed, but they increased the demand for residual use. And the net result, though, was no change to ending stocks for soybeans. So no big news there on the domestic front. And then on the wheat market, what they did do was reduce export demand. And so that made the carryout number just a little bit larger. But, you know, today's report largely priced in. Usually the March report doesn't have a lot of big expectations. Traders, I think, were curious to see if the USDA was going to make any adjustments to Brazil and Argentina corn and soybean production numbers, and they did not. So without any fresh news to trade on, kind of probably going to go back into a modest trading range, start to weather watch in South America, keep an eye on any geopolitical uncertainty going down the road, and now already shifting gears and focusing on the March 31st quarterly stocks and prospective planting report coming up now just in a couple weeks.
It is important to note as well that USDA did make one other change in the soybean supply and demand table. That was to drop the season's average cash price, which will include sales that come from the time that this was released today until we get to the end of the month of August. by 15 cents to $9.95. No change on corn at $4.35, and they dropped the wheat number by a nickel to $5.55. Those were all for old crop. Did they make any changes in the global stocks that you made note of, for instance, in wheat?
Yes, so they did increase the global wheat ending stocks up to 260.08 million metric tons. That was up from 257.56 last month. So there was a production increase. That was where the ending stocks got a little bit larger. So they increased production for Russia slightly, and they increased production in Ukraine slightly. Also, Australian production increased slightly. So those three changes to global production is why the global ending stocks got a little bit bigger for the wheat.
Does this give you any pause as you think about it on the coarse grain side of things, as it's related to the price of corn on the global stage, a price of wheat on the global stage, or is it par for the course?
I feel like we're just kicking the can down the road. We're waiting to get a better handle on harvest numbers coming in from South America. We're getting ready to just get a better handle on the next leg of corn production for that second crop, safrinha corn in Brazil. All of that corn is accounted for and spoken for, and the demand is there on the export front. So we're going to be weather watching down there. And just again, I feel like where the market is and the USDA maybe just trying to punt, kick the can down the road until we get a better handle more on the geopolitical issues out there. There's still plenty of directions for this market to go, depending on the demand side going forward from the U.S. perspective of exports. But when you think about how weather can change on a dime and how tight U.S. corn ending stocks are and how global ending stocks of corn are still tight, there's reasons why this market could see that seasonal push higher into the Mother's Day, Father's Day timeframe for a summer rally. So at the end of the day, you just got to be ready for anything that unfolds. But right now, the focus for traders is going to be more on South American weather, keeping an eye on our weekly export sales, and then also watching trade and tariff talk. That's going to be the market mover probably for the next couple weeks.
Last week, you were in Denver at the Commodity Classic. Did you learn anything new from the farmers you spoke with?
When they stopped by the booth, we talked a lot about weather, talking about how dry it is out there right now, talking about how if you compare this year's drought monitor index for this week of history versus the same week in 2012, the drought monitor index is substantially drier right now, with even like two-thirds of Illinois in that drought monitor index for a very modest drought beginning, and even portions of Indiana. And that's very different from how 2012 started. So a lot of just thoughtful conversations, producers just, I think, really wanting to focus on whatever kind of a price rally we can see this summer, wanting to make sure that they're capturing it, focusing on cash sales, risk management. So it was a great show. And again, a lot of thoughtful conversation.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Naomi Bloom. She is with TotalFarmMarketing.com. Let's turn our attention now to autonomous agriculture on the farm. Last week, during the All Day Ag Outlook, the director of the Center for Digital Agriculture here on the campus of the University of Illinois, John Reed, addressed this topic. He worked for John Deere for 19 years and actually started here on campus prior to that. I can recall working with him and his team on a self-driving tractor in the late 1990s. He began his address during the All Day Ag Outlook by discussing John Deere's autonomous agriculture. Last year, the manufacturer introduced autonomous tillage. This year, it extended that across other operations.
Actually, really interesting with John Deere, they're also seeing that this farm management information system, which they call OpsCenter, links to other spaces even. So it's used for agriculture today, but if they're going to do autonomy in construction or in golf courses, these other places where there's labor and lots of machinery challenges, then you need to have the same kind of thing. So What is in an autonomous tractor? First of all, it's a highly automated tractor to begin with. It doesn't have to be. Actually, you'll see a lot of companies that will retrofit a vehicle by putting autonomy kit on an existing tractor. But if it's highly automated, it's got more electronic surfaces that can be controlled through software, makes it easier to integrate with the autonomous vehicle. Actually, you're talking about the example in Champaign. That was the first Magnum tractor from Case IH that had a CAN bus on it. And for a researcher, it was really a nice way of doing autonomy, because usually I had to give the tractors back every year to the company. I'd spend 6 months making it into a robot tractor and in 3 months doing work. Well, with the changes of having electronics backbone and networks, it became a 1 week job of converting a tractor into an autonomous vehicle. So you've got this highly automated tractor. It's got an ability to sense what's happening in its environment. That's called situational awareness. Most commonly, we think about GPS telling where the vehicle is and how you could use that to plant straight or to do operations more efficiently. Through automatic guidance, as an example. But it has other situational awareness that's needed too, because the most important part of a tractor operating in the field is the operator sitting in the seat and sensing what's going on around the vehicle and in the implement system, as well as understanding what's happening in the field. Where do you want to go? So it's just not an issue of nobody does automatic tractoring or just driving the tractor around the field. You have an implement, you're doing a work task, you're trying to get a job done, and so there's extra sensors needed. Today, we're starting to see cameras and other types of sensing like that that are looking out ahead of the vehicle to look for people, to sense the rows, and then also those cameras are looking around the vehicle and seeing the implement and trying to understand, is the implement doing its job? What's really interesting in this space, though, is it's really not autonomy of the driving, but autonomy of the implement itself. And if you've heard of precision spraying technology like ExactApply from John Deere, or other See and Spray types of technologies, these technologies are putting the AI and the intelligence on the implement and allowing the implement to work at a level that's beyond what has been possible in the past, being able to very precisely spray individual weeds and save chemical and get those benefits, but then still have an operator in the seat. And I think this is really kind of an important point about this, is that if we are going to be doing these operations, we need implements that can be able to sense things that are working and not working that today depend on the operator or the farmer in the seat to detect. So think about a debris on a plow shank or some types of effects, something breaking. Right now, a lot of the implements are not instrumented to be able to tell that something's wrong. So if you really are going to have effective autonomy, you don't want to kind of come back to the field where a tractor just finished operating and seeing that it hadn't completed its operations. So anyhow, this intelligent implement side is not really autonomy, but it is an element that also has to emerge if autonomous agriculture is going to take place. So again, we have the tractor, we have guidance systems, we have situational awareness or perception on the vehicle, and then usually these are tied into some kind of farm management information system for autonomy. That system is used to essentially understand the fields where you're going to operate, understand what kind of path plans, and AI is used to generate those plans to cover a field. And for some operations like tillage, that's all you need. You basically can designate that the operator, the farmer, moves the vehicle to the field, and then you can get out and execute the task. I want to come back to this because that's just, we're seeing a lot of the visual videos of demonstrating the task working. But when you really think about this, a lot of operations, like if you're planting or anything that has spraying, anything that has materials and inputs that you have to manage, there's a lot of work besides just the execution of the planting or spraying task. You have to consider how do you resupply, and actually in some cases there's a robotics company that's looking at automating the material logistics and moving materials to and fro, which seems like also a good idea and be really important for a fully autonomous system. So where do these examples pay off? And I'll give a couple of examples for you. It tends to be for many of the applications where there's a lot of already labor involved, and autonomy is a way of getting better performance output out of labor that could be low skilled and displace some of that. So one example, and there's a study by the Western Growers about a system called Carbon Robotics. It's not a autonomous system, but it's a very intelligent laser weed control system. Very expensive. It's about $1 million just for the implement. But in those operations where you have three crews of 25 people weeding in the field, this kind of system has a payback and can provide value in that particular scenario. So again, that's one scenario. So what's coming with these technologies is that, as I said, I think it's a long journey. We're seeing a lot of the initial things, like we asked in the guidance questions. There are a few early adopters that are trying these technologies. And I think we're going to see moving through the hype as industry gets more experience. We're going to see more and more examples of this. It is not going to be for everyone. In fact, I would say if you are interested in autonomy, the journey is still start with automation and get the value of the productivity of automatic guidance and some of these other type of things. And integrating into farm management information systems is kind of a next step. Autonomy will be more complex because it's like a suite of technologies that integrate together. And yes, the technology readiness is there. We're still working on the viability and understanding the business model. And there is some customer value on certain types of applications in terms of, especially around labor productivity and performance.
John Reed is the director at the Center for Digital Agriculture on the Urbana-Champaign campus at the University of Illinois. That was a portion of an address he made to last week's All Day Ag Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. If you'd like to hear all of it or more from the All Day Ag Outlook, you can find those presentations on our website. They're audio only at willag.org. Look for the article name that includes the All Day Ag Outlook 2025. Now, also last week, Neil Dahlstrom joined us. He's the author of the book Tractor Wars. The documentary based on that book will air tonight on our companion station, WILL Channel 12, at 7 p.m. Be sure to tune in then. Neil was on hand last week for a book signing and talked just a little bit about the documentary and the book.
If you don't want to hear the story, close your ears. Just plug your ears, right? Because I don't want to give it away. But basically, the bookends are 1908. This young, up-and-coming car manufacturer named Henry Ford, who no one's ever heard of, sends a photo and a paragraph to a publication called the Farm Implement News and says, I'm building a farm tractor, and it's going to be out really soon. And so you imagine people, you know, opening up the Farm Implement News and reading it and going, yeah, okay, I think I've heard of this word tractor before. I don't know who this Henry Ford dude is, but like, okay, big deal. Well, a month later, Henry Ford rolls something else out called the Model T, and all of a sudden, a lot of people have heard of Henry Ford. But he's a farm kid. That's kind of the beginning of this journey. The farm tractor industry's couple hundred machines from maybe six or seven manufacturers at that period in time. So that's kind of the starting point. The next important piece happens in 1909. Cyrus McCormick Jr., the CEO of International Harvester, and William Butterworth, the CEO of John Deere, have a meeting. Cyrus McCormick says, I heard that you're going to get into the harvesting business. And if you do that, we're going to go into the plow business. And William Butterworth says, no, we're not doing that. We'd never do that, but I heard that you're getting into the plow business, and if you do that, we're going to go into the harvesting business. Of course, they're both doing this already behind the scenes, right? So that kind of sets this up. International Harvester is 10 times the size of John Deere at the time. They're a $100 million a year company, and this kind of triggers a lot of this, what they're trying to build, what they call a full line. So that's 1909. Fast forward a little bit. The farm tractor, not really widely adopted. We're talking about these big, what they call prairie tractors. They're 60, 70 horsepower machines. They're in Canada, they're out west. In 1913, this company comes along called the Bull Tractor Company, and they do something amazing. They go, oh, the average farm size in the United States is 40 to 50 acres. Why don't we build a tractor that's suitable for the average size farmer? This is what an editor called the gorgeous nightmare period, which is everything just went chaotic. Now every entrepreneur, every technology person, every ag implement manufacturer decides they're getting into the tractor business. The Bull sells a whopping 3,000 tractors in 1913. 5 years later, they're bankrupt because it turns out building a tractor is really, really hard. Where's Henry Ford? Still trying to design a farm tractor because it turns out that building a farm tractor is really, really hard. Takes him all the way until 1918. John Deere starts R&D in 1912. They introduced their first farm tractor in 1918, and that's where this started with me. People would say, what took John Deere so long to get into the tractor business? And I would say, well, 1918 feels really early to me, and they were before the people who were after them, but they were after the people who were before them. That meant Neil doesn't know the answer, so he's going to try to confuse you. That's what really started the research. So John Deere gets into the business. International Harvester is the big player. By 1925, there's 160 tractor manufacturers in the United States. They're building 200,000 tractors a year. Henry Ford has 75% market share. He introduces the Fordson in 1918. He's got 75% market share. The industry is evolving. We had things happen like a world war, a global pandemic, all of these things, all this context, which is really important, an ag recession, price wars in the early 1920s. So there's a lot going on in this period. Henry Ford starts hemorrhaging market share in the automobile business and has to make a decision. So he goes from 75% market share in 1925 to almost nothing in 1928 because he withdraws from the tractor industry and we start over. International Harvester's at the top again, Deere's number two. They're selling about 75 to 80% and everyone else is trying to figure it out. That's the entire book in about 5 minutes. Hopefully we did okay there, you followed me. So that led to this great call I got about a year and a half ago from Iowa PBS. One of their producers says, well, I got your book for Christmas. Have you ever thought about doing a documentary? And I said, no, because I don't know how to do documentaries. But that kind of led down this road of producing this documentary with PBS that came out last year. And as of, I think, two days ago, it's being released nationally. So hopefully everyone's going to get to see this documentary, and I'm really excited about it.
If you'd like to watch the Tractor Wars documentary based on Neil Dostrom's book, you're in luck. It airs tonight at 7 p.m. on our companion station, WILL-TV, Channel 12. Up next, Don Day of Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming, is here to take a look at the weather forecast.
Very mild spring-like conditions have been noted here over the last week over many areas of the U.S., and it will stay that way till the end of the week and the weekend when things change. We're going to see a strong storm hit the California coast early this week and then spread out into the northern plains by Friday and Saturday. We're going to see a significant snow event for parts of Minnesota, the eastern side of North Dakota, South Dakota, and parts of northeast Nebraska. That area will see winter storm conditions. Very strong winds will develop across the southern plains. And then we're going to see severe weather across the Mississippi Valley areas and parts of the southeastern United States and maybe getting into the eastern Corn Belt as strong thunderstorms will develop along that cold front. Now, colder air behind that system will spread in this weekend and early next week, putting an end to the warmer temperatures, much colder temperatures in many areas of the Corn Belt by the weekend. Temperatures will then rebound early next week, only to see another system arrive late next week. So the up and down, pendulum swinging type patterns that you get this time of year look to be on tap as we go into the middle part of March.
Thank you much, Don. Don Day is with Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online at willag.org, willag.org. Have a good afternoon. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.